Right now on the Daily Debrief, shocking testimony in the military trial of a Navy SEAL accused of murdering an ISIS fighter. A verdict in the case of a Florida man accused of a drug-infused triple murder. And closing arguments in the death penalty phase of a California trial involving the murders of all four members of the McStay family. The Daily Debrief recaps the day in court. It's Thursday, June 20th.
Good evening. We have a packed broadcast on the Debrief tonight, so let's get straight to it. Bombshell testimony in the trial of a Navy SEAL accused of killing an injured ISIS fighter in Iraq. Eddie Gallagher is being tried on charges of premeditated murder and aggravated assault. But today, a surprise which may have crippled the military's chief claim against him. Chief Investigative Correspondent Brian Ross picks up a report from the newsroom.
Oh, good afternoon, Eric. 39-year-old Eddie Gallagher is a decorated Navy SEAL. Former SEALs who worked with him say he is accused of killing random Iraqi civilians from a sniper position, but the most serious charge involves an allegation that he stabbed to death this Iraqi teenager, a captured ISIS fighter, seen here in Iraqi TV footage made apparently shortly before Gallagher allegedly killed him. The bombshell testimony today came from a Navy medic who was at the scene who testified that he, in fact, was the one who killed the captured teenage fighter. Corey Scott testified that when he saw Gallagher unexpectedly stab him, he decided he had to kill the teenager by cutting off oxygen flow in his tube, asphyxiating him. He said he did it as an act of mercy. Scott testified under a grant of testimonial immunity and said that he killed the teenager because he feared he was going to be tortured by Iraqi forces. Asked in court by the prosecutors, by Tim Parlatore, he testified, "I knew he was going to die anyway and wanted to save him from waking up to whatever would have happened to him next." The testimony came from Gallagher's defense lawyer, Tim Parlatore, who appeared here last week on the Law and Crime Network and talked to me about how he was going to, quote, eviscerate the Navy SEALs who were going to testify in the case.
I'm absolutely saying that they're lying. I'm looking forward to cross-examining them. You know, they're supposed to be our nation's elite warriors, and yet I look at NCIS videos of them crying as they're telling stories that then when you pull out the video of the actual event, they're clearly lying about. So I can't wait to get these guys on the stand.
And you're going to take them apart, you say?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We intend to annihilate the government's case.
If the testimony today holds up, it would appear the murder charge against Eddie Gallagher would not survive the case. Aaron?
So, Brian, the government will probably go after Eddie Gallagher for attempted murder here rather than murder. That's because of the stabbing. So how might that proceed legally?
Well, in fact, the sentence for attempted murder could be life, and that's all he faced for the murder charge itself. A judge had earlier ruled that life without parole was taken off the table, as was a possible death sentence. For the medic who testified today, Aaron, defense lawyers say he may face perjury charges from the government. They say he told this story, this version, for the first time today and not had said it earlier.
That was my next question. Okay, Brian, so different charge potentially for Gallagher, same penalty. Chief Investigative Correspondent Brian Ross in the newsroom, thank you tonight. A verdict in the death penalty case against one of the two men accused of showing up to a party with guns and masks and murdering three people. Christopher Vasada is accused of murdering 20-year-old Kelly Doherty, 26-year-old Sean Henry, and 24-year-old Brandy El-Sahi. Police found Vasada injured about a mile away from the shooting scene near his own car. They say he was carrying a glove, a gun magazine, and a bullet. Co-defendant Marcus Stewart is also charged in connection with the case. The state believes the two parked a mile away, walked to the scene, committed the murders, and then planned to flee back to their cars. But Vasada was accidentally injured, so the pair is accused of stealing a car to get back to their own vehicles. Gloves recovered from that stolen car contain DNA from both of these defendants. Here are some of today's verdicts.
We, the jury, find as follows. As to count one, Sean Henry, we find a defendant guilty of first-degree murder with a firearm as charged in the indictment. As to count two, Brandy El-Sahi, we find a defendant guilty of first-degree murder with a firearm as charged in the indictment. During the commission of this offense, did the defendant himself discharge a firearm, which discharge caused a death or serious bodily injury to Brandy El-Sahi? No. During the commission of this offense, did the defendant himself discharge a firearm? Yes. During the commission of this offense, did the defendant himself actually possess a firearm? Yes. As to count three, Kelly Doherty, we find the defendant guilty of first-degree murder with a firearm as charged in the indictment. During the commission of this offense, did the defendant himself discharge a firearm, which discharge caused a death or serious bodily injury to Kelly Doherty? No. During the commission of this offense, did the defendant himself discharge a firearm? Yes. During the commission of this offense, did the defendant himself actually possess a firearm? Yes. As to count four, we find the defendant guilty of attempted first-degree murder with a firearm as charged in the indictment.
We will talk about that interesting verdict in just a moment. It was a conviction across the board, but you heard the nuances there. But first, let's go back to the state's closing argument.
On a night when most of America was watching football or enjoying friends and family, two men, possibly three men, decided to embark on a mission of evil as Charlie Orpagel, Sean Henry, Brandy Alzalvi, and Kelly Doherty, all in their 20s, were sitting around a fire pit laughing. When Chris Masada, Marcus Stewart, clothed in dark clothes, black t-shirts, black hoodies, armed to the teeth, with an assault rifle, a Glock, extra magazines, extra ammo, and something wicked this way came. And they ambushed four helpless sitting ducks sitting out in their backyard.
The state pointed jurors to evidence of premeditation and away from defense claims that the victims had enemies in the drug community.
Kelly Doherty was 20 years old. Kelly Doherty wasn't armed that night. Kelly Doherty wasn't a drug dealer. Brandy Alzalvi, University of Florida, 24 years old. She wasn't armed. She wasn't a drug dealer. Those two girls had nothing to do with that underbelly dark drug trade in Jupiter, Florida, that Masada, Luke Kasukos, Laura Pagel, and Sean Henry were involved in. Those two girls were Charlie Laura Pagel was not on that night. Sean Henry had a gun tucked in his waistband that remained tucked in his waistband after he was shot 17 times. This was a cold, calculated, premeditated murder execution plot to get Charlie Borpagel and Sean Henry off guard when they were outside of the home. Charlie Borpagel had a lot of guns in there. He knew that. They knew we can't get Charlie in his house because he's got a gun within reach.
The defense argued that the state did not live up to its burden to prove the defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt because too many people at the party where the shooting occurred were either doing drugs or dealing drugs. Again, the defense case was that those people had enemies.
So when Charles Vorpagel came into this courtroom and he took an oath, when he talked about Mr. Masada, he repeatedly used one word, friend. They were friends. The same word that he used when he talked about Sean Henry. They were friends. There had never been a conflict between them. They had never had a fight. They had never shot guns at each other. They had never hurt each other. None of that had happened. They were friends. Now, Mr. Vorpagel, after this happens, comes in here and tells you, well, now I question that because I believe he was involved. But that's just speculation. When you examine the phone records of Mr. Vasada, there are only a handful of contacts that are actually named in the phone records. There's about seven. Two of those are Charlie and Sean Henry, two of Mr. Vasada's longest friends. And there are phone calls that are exchanged between them throughout the weekend. And Charlie admits to you that there are text messages exchanged between them throughout the weekend. Luke Kasukas is not a contact in Mr. Vasada's phone, nor is Marcus Stewart.
The defense also reminded the jury that some testimony suggested the presence of another possible trigger man, that Luke Kasukas, whose name you just heard, whose alibi that night was not airtight.
What conclusions can you draw about the 7.62, the rifle shell casings in the backyard at Mohawk? We know that the person who was firing that rifle, a person Charlie Vorpagel believed was Luke Kasukas, a person whose face Charlie Vorpagel saw illuminated by the larger muzzle flash of the rifle, a person Charlie Vorpagel described as looking and sounding distinctly like Luke Kasukas, a person whose description looks nothing like Mr. Vasada or even Mr. Stewart, but which perfectly matches Luke Kasukas. We know that that person fired that rifle 17 times. The state tells you it does not matter. They tell you it does not matter who fired an assault rifle 17 times in a series of seconds and murdered three people with it.
Joining me tonight are attorneys Brian Buckmeyer and Bob Hillett to discuss this case. So, Bob, this was a conviction as to all. This was conviction across the board, but the verdict was interesting because the jury found that the bullets did cause death or serious injury to Sean Henry, but did not cause death or serious injury to the two women killed. How does that work legally?
Well, my understanding in Florida is that there's two ways you can get murder in the first degree. One is obviously from killing the intended victim. The other one is a felony murder where you're involved. And of course, in this case, he killed that one person and they're working with the others. And the other ones were killed. He's also charged with killing those people as well.
That was my assessment as well. Brian, do you agree?
Absolutely agree. Legally speaking, there are two differences, but for Mr. Vasada, it's the same. He's found guilty. It's probably going to be a similar sentencing as well.
And again, we have another alleged shooter here. Maybe the jury found that that shooter's bullets were the ones that directly caused the death. But if you're involved with this, if you're there, you're pulling the trigger and your bullets don't happen to hit a couple of the victims, you can still be convicted of it.
And you're hearing that in this segment we just saw.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So let's ask this question as well. Brian, the thing that did this case for me, that convinced me that this was a conviction, was the DNA in the glove and the getaway car. You got this defendant trying to say, oh, it could have been these other trigger men, there were drug deals, there was this, that, and the other thing going on. But, okay, why is he bringing gloves? Why are the gloves in the getaway car with his DNA?
So oftentimes when we hear about a case, they tell you about the chronology as of from the shooting and then the getaway and then going backwards. But in terms of the investigation, they're going to do the opposite. They're going to work backwards from the glove, the DNA, and bring it all the way back to the shooting. And so those connections, those leaps of circumstances lead to guilty verdicts like this.
Exactly. Gentlemen, we'll see you again at the end of the broadcast. Still ahead tonight here on The Debrief, we return to the McStay family murders in California. Closing arguments in the penalty phase of the case. The jury must decide whether it's death or life in prison for defendant Chase Merritt. That is after the break. Closing arguments from the defense today in the penalty phase of a California trial involving the murders of a family of four. A jury convicted Chase Merritt of killing business associate Joseph McStay and McStay's family. The trial started in January and has dragged on for more than 5 months. The state's penalty phase of the case contained a lot of testimony from surviving family members. But the state's closing also focused on the brutality of the killings. Remember, the victims were beaten to death, presumably with a hammer found in their graves.
Remember how he was described as a person? Forgiving, generous, loving, would give the shirt off his back. That's how that person was described. But remember that person in context of the circumstances of the offense. All of this was in light of repeated tales of the defendant's failings as a business partner. Messed up projects like Levine and Provetra. Fonseca notifying him of the diversion of funds and equipment. Cicada telling him about, well, you can continue to pay him, we're doing most of the work. Still a forgiving, generous individual in light of all that. So despite all of that, the defendant kept taking advantage of Joseph, forging checks, relying on him for emergency funds, for rent and other purposes, all to be found buried in a grave 3 years, 9 months, 7 days later. But look at the injuries. You can even see one in that initial photograph, which is the gaping hole in the back of his skull as he lays in that grave. The massive force of impact that must have occurred to shatter a human skull that severely.
The defense took a huge risk by not presenting a mitigation case. That's a case to try to save their client's life during this phase of the trial. Instead, the defense continued to fire back at the gaps in the state's case, even though this same jury agreed the case was strong enough for a conviction.
When the prosecution is using phrases like greed and theft and off the grid, you and I, when we go to bed and we put our phone next to us, or we go to a location where there's no reception, or we turn off our phones for whatever reason, or we run out of battery, like I frequently do. That's what happens in life, not with Chase Merritt. He's off the grid. Off the grid, so he can go clean the killing mess in Fallbrook. More time. It's all nonsense, and there's no evidence of it. It's a story. Remember the easy part about saying who? I can point the finger at whoever. They're skilled lawyers. Surely they can do it and say, make up anything they want around it. And it sounds chilling. It sounds chilling when you say somebody's greedy and they're a thief and they're this and they're that. And we're going, yeah. And then you have a grieving family. We want to do something for that family. So we're receptive to those words, especially when they're barked out so loud and so convincingly.
The defense strategy here is to use any remaining doubt in the mind of any juror, maybe even one juror, as leverage toward a verdict of life in prison.
In retrospect, the prosecution's case is nothing. It's barking and screaming. And there's no substance to it. You got character assassination. You got gambling, greed, checks, backdate, QuickBooks, blah, blah, blah. And whatever they said to you, with no exaggeration, whatever they said to you about QuickBooks was either taken out of context or unimportant and irrelevant. Why? Because there was never a theft, ever. So being the realist that I am, I understand that many of you have tuned me out and will continue to tune me out, and that's okay. Because I know there's a few of you who understand what I'm saying and agree with at least the premise that you may have been sold a bill of goods. Because you have. And you don't know it now because you can't have access to anything. You will know it soon. You're not only going to be able to see the trial, but you're going to see the motions, everything that you guys had to wait outside for, you're going to see it all. It's all on the internet, every day. And you're going to see what I'm telling you is true. You're going to see that these prosecutors sold you a bill of goods. You're going to see that this family is not getting justice. At some point, you will reflect on this, and maybe you will watch that gavel-to-gavel coverage, and you'll say, there was no evidence. There was a lot of barking and a lot of screaming and a lot of shouting, but there was no evidence.
Returning tonight are attorneys Brian Buckmeyer and Bob Hilla. Mike Korobanix is also joining us from the newsroom right now. So, Mike, let me start with you here. What do you make of this defense strategy, basically not to put on any mitigation case here, rather use the closing arguments to try to fire back at some of the gaps in the case and hoping there's a lingering doubt in there. Does that strategy work?
I think it's the most effective strategy they have right now. The one thing I don't like about the strategy he's using is when he's really casting derogatory statements to the prosecution. He's walking a very fine line here. This jury convicted them. So to say that when you insult the prosecution, you're basically insulting the jury because you're saying they sold you a bill of goods and you guys bought it. What I think he needs to say here is that the case really has some doubt, and even though you convicted them, you really can't get over this second hurdle, and that second hurdle of sentencing someone to death is a difficult hurdle to clear, and I think that would have been a better tactic. I just don't think insulting the prosecution helps because you're really insulting the jury.
You know, this is a tough argument for the defense to make, but it's at least intellectually consistent with the rest of the case, so I give the defense credit for that. But Brian Buckmeyer, what do you make of this other tactic, of sort of shoving the jury to go and watch the trial later and then think about it and to try to project itself forward and to try to, at this point, alleviate or prevent any eventual fear that the wrong decision was reached?
So I think the word you use, shove, is actually perfect. And when you're shoving someone, you want to make sure that you're doing it in a way that doesn't harm them, that doesn't push them too far. And to Mike's point, I think the choice of words might be a little bit too abrasive and a little bit too much. And to only go with relitigating, I think that's not the smartest choice. I think that should be part of your arsenal. I think mitigation should also have been brought in there, because at this point, you've got to throw everything in and the kitchen sink.
You know, Bob, this was a really tough case. Most of us who watched it here really had some serious concerns. I keep going back to this unknown DNA in the graves. The defense brought it up. I would have kept shoving that during the closings and made that the beginning, middle, and end of the closings and turn around and say, hey, look, we still don't know what's up with the unknown DNA in the graves.
Well, he's definitely taken the jury head on here. But I think that what he's also looking at is lingering doubt is the only way to go. You had a jury that deliberated on this case for 22 hours over the course of maybe 5 days. So obviously there were some difficulties in that. And he's hoping that one or more of them has a question here.
Exactly. Great panel tonight. Thanks a lot, Mike, for coming back and joining us the second half. Thanks to the other two gentlemen seated here in the studio with me. We're out of time here on The Debrief. We're going to continue to monitor the McStay case for deliberations pushing into the evening. I'll see you back here tomorrow on the Law and Crime Network at 5 p.m. Eastern. Good night.